Great. So it is 7 o'clock. Thank you for joining us today. I'm Scott Schiff, hosting Atlas Society's senior fellow Rob Trzezinski, talking about objectivism and futurism. I'd ask everyone to share the room and please raise your hand if you want to join the conversation. Rob, thanks for doing this topic. What can objectivism tell us about the future?
Okay, great. So I decided to broach this one because I mentioned the idea of futurism the other day, and somebody asked me, well, what the heck is futurism? And I thought, well, that's a good question, because it's one of these things that tends to be sort of used in a loosey-goosey way to, you know, I guess make somebody's visionary new book, allegedly visionary new book, sound good and exciting and make them sound like the visionary they want to be, whether that's actually true or not. So I wanted to talk a little bit about what that means, but also why do we need such a concept? What's the purpose of such a thing? And then what does it have to do with, what does philosophy have to contribute to that? And what does objectivism specifically have to attribute? So let's start with what is futurism? So I say, what is futurism? Futurism I described as attempts to predict and explain changes due to advancing technology. And specifically, changes to the way we're going to live, changes to our lifestyle, changes to, you know, not just, you know, the newest model of car will have a couple extra features, but things that are actually going to make a substantive difference to the way that we live and work and play and what our lifestyle is going to be. So it's, you know, how technology will change the way we live. So it's attempt to predict and to explain that. All right. Now, obviously, there's an overlap here with the role of philosophy, because it's talking about what affects how you live your life, what kind of life you have, what's possible to you in the world. And, you know, one's approaching it from the technological perspective, and the other's approaching it from this sort of wider perspective of what's possible to human beings, you know, given the nature of reality, given human nature, what's possible to us. And the other saying, okay, but then very specifically, given this new technology, what's that going to do? For, you know, there's all sorts of examples. Just go to the past, because I'm going to go to the past, because there are things that aren't somebody's visionary dream, but they're things that have actually happened, right? So, for example, if you look at the way transportation has changed over the last 200 years, right, with first railroads and steamships and automobiles and airplanes, people are orders of magnitude more mobile. We're more casually mobile than we used to do, and it has changed how we live and how we look at the world. I think it's kind of interesting thing. When I moved to Virginia, one thing I noticed is that if you go on any of the roads around here, every 5 miles you see some little sign for a place, a town, a village, or something like that doesn't really exist anymore. There's a couple of old buildings. But you realize that, you know, 200 years ago, when this was all settled, see, I wasn't used to seeing this in the Midwest, because in the Midwest, you go back 200 years and there was nothing there, right? It was prairie. But, you know, 200 years ago in Virginia, there was something here. And every 5 miles, there was a little town. Oftentimes, they have a name like Station, meaning there's a railroad station there. Or like Kent's store is one nearby, or Holly's store is another one nearby. So there's a store or a station. There was some reason why people would go there, but they're every 5 miles. And I realized the reason they were every 5 miles is because that's how far you could travel by foot or by horse within, you know, as a day trip. You know, you go in, if you had to go in to buy something at the store and come back, you couldn't really go more than a couple of miles there and a couple of miles back. It was unrealistic to go travel any farther. So obviously, the technology of transportation has radically changed how we view that sort of thing. I go about 30 miles to go shopping for groceries these days, which would have been inconceivable back then. All right, so that's part of the story. So it's looking at, you know, the question of what's possible to man, what is possible to us, how, in what way should we live, in what way can we live? But from a more specific angle than the philosopher looks at it, which is, you know, how is specific technology going to change that? Now, here's the problem, though. In my experience, a lot of futurism that you read out there, if you go to a technology site or, you know, this whole genre was sort of kicked off by Alvin Toffler in the 60s and 70s when he did something called The Third Wave about how information technology was going to change everything, which he was right about, you know. But a lot of the futurism that you see these days, if you go to technology sites, is sort of a projection of various fantasies of the future based less on what real technology is actually doing or you know, near future technology is actually doing, but more based on the philosophy, the existing philosophy of the person who's writing it and what he would like to be true, what he would like to have happen. The biggest example I saw of this, so my background on this is about 6 or 7 years ago now, I started and ran for a while a site called Real Clear Future, which is it was under the Real Clear umbrella. And eventually and I did this thing called Real Clear Future, which was basically talking about emerging technology, talking about stuff that was 5, 10, 15 years down the road. You know, are we going to have fusion power? Are we going to have self-driving cars? That kind of thing. It was basically what Elon Musk got up and tweeted something today. Was it visionary or was it flim-flam? That kind of thing. And when I wrote about that, the main thing that struck me when I started sort of surveying what was being done in this field is there were a lot of these things that were out there that people were saying and repeating over and over again that didn't have a whole lot of basis in fact, but they had a lot of basis in wish fulfillment fantasy, right? So one of them is like, for example, electric vehicles and fossil fuels. Fossil fuels are on their way out. Electric vehicles, electric power is going to totally replace them. It's all going to happen soon because it's just around the corner. It's all going to happen soon. And there was not any really great basis for believing this. It became the fashion because the people's pre-existing commitment to environmentalism, to the global warming theory. And so if they wanted to be technologically optimistic and imagine a prosperous future or an advanced future, they had to say, oh, well, then therefore it's all got to be electric vehicles and solar power and fossil fuels are on their way out. But it was all a lot, 90% of that was way more wish fulfillment. I wish this would be the result rather than actually having strong evidence that's already happening or is likely to happen. Another one is somebody you may have heard. There's a guy came out with a book called Fully Automated Luxury Communism. And this is the old dream. It's like not even a new thing that somebody's come up with, that we're going to have automation and artificial intelligence and super automation of all production is going to come along, and the machines are going to do all the work for us. And so we can finally make communism work. You know, it didn't work the other 700 times we tried it. Now we're finally going to make it work because the machines will do all the work, and we can all sit back and equally share in the rewards and have the ideal communist society. And it'll be luxurious. It'll be advanced. It'll be highly wealthy. And it'll be fully automated because the machines are going to do everything. And of course, there's no reason to believe that this is imminent, much less, little reason to believe it's practical at all. No reason to believe it's imminent. But again, it's that wish fulfillment of, we tried communism 700 times. Maybe now this 701st time, the technology, the robots will come along and the technology will help us make it work. So a lot of futurism does tend to be people taking their pre-existing philosophical commitments and sort of engaging less in scientific analysis than in science fiction, where they sort of project what they would like the ideal future to be and sort of fudge over all the details. All right. Now, part of the problem with futurism is that, the old saying, predictions are hard, especially about the future, right? So it is very difficult to make predictions about what is going to happen 5 years from now, 15 years from now, what kind of power supplies are we going to have, what kind of machines are we going to have or not have. People like me have spent our entire lives waiting for the flying cars to arrive. And we went past 2015, which is why when we had flying cars in Back to the Future Part 2. And we went past 2019, which is when we had flying cars in a dystopian future in Blade Runner. It was a dystopia when we had flying cars in 2019. Didn't happen, right? So there's all sorts of predictions that end up being wrong. And so that because the prediction it's inherently kind of a speculative field, I mean, you provide that much scope for speculation, you provide a lot of scope for people to read their wishes into the future rather than, you know, have a clear-eyed view of what's actually happening. On the other hand, though, it's not totally a lost cause because there have been some predictions that are quite good. I suggest you go online, you can find these. There's a set of AT&T ads from the 1990s. And what makes them extra delicious is they were, the way they were published, I think it was in Newsweek, one of these big news magazines that no longer even like is a shadow of its former self. One of these news magazines, I think it's probably in Time, that they published it as an insert, but it was an insert on CD-ROM. So, you know, to show how futuristic they were putting it on CD-ROM, which is a technology that has, you know, been and gone since then. But it was a series of ads narrated by Tom Selleck from AT&T talking about all this amazing new technology that was on the way. And, you know, things like you're going to be able to send a fax from the beach. And you're going to be, you know, it shows somebody with basically a tablet computer, which, you know, didn't really exist then, but, you know, this is, they were projecting the future. Somebody with a tablet computer, you know, sending a fax from their chair at a beachside resort. Now, you know, there's some unintentional irony there that, yes, you could do exactly what they're talking about. You could send somebody a PDF of a document from your tablet on the beach, but who uses the fax these days, right? You know, things like automated pay, automated tolls. You know, you can pay a toll without even stopping. We do that now. You know, if you can do that, if you get this little pass thing that you mount on the inside of your windshield, you can do that in Northern Virginia on the Beltway. And so there's all sorts of things that this thing predicted and got right that were technology that was 5, 10, 15, 20 years off in the future from when they made it. Now, so it is possible to make some projections based on what's going on with existing technology about how things are going to change. Now, it's possible to make very broad predictions. Getting the specifics right is very difficult because, you know, the most ironic part of that whole ad campaign is that each one of them ends with this tagline, and the people who will bring it to you, AT&T. And of course, they didn't bring all that to us. Somebody else, you know, they brought some of it. They provided some of the telecommunications infrastructure for it. But, you know, if you thought, oh, AT&T is going to be the one basically providing everything that comes on the internet today, well, no, it ended up being provided by, you know, 100 other different people. So, you know, it is possible to get the broad outlines correct while getting a lot of the details wrong. Now, so the question that if it is possible to do this, if it's possible to make these sort of predictions or speculations and not be completely wrong, the question is, why is it necessary? What's the value of this? Why should we be doing this? Well, two main things, I think, because one is it helps us to prepare. And this is my big sales pitch when I did Real Clear Future of why you should be thinking about this is if these changes are coming, you know, if you have 5, 10, 15 years of warning that these things are happening, you get to prepare for them. You get to realize what's going, you know, you realize ahead of time what's going to happen, and you can position yourself to be in the best situation to take advantage of it. Now, not in this very specific sense of, oh, I'm going to buy AT&T stock because they're going to bring me all these things, because you could be very wrong about that. But more in the sense of if we are in an age of increasing automation, and it is possible to automate things now today that people couldn't automate before, then you should be, you know, if you're in a career or a job that can be automated, it's good to know that ahead of time, right? Because you know that, you know, my sitting around filling out forms that can easily be done by a computer, that's going to be a job, that's a dead-end job. I better look to acquire skills or, you know, go into some sort of management position or do something so that I'm not the one doing the replaceable thing. I'm the one doing something that is not easily replaceable. Now, the second reason why futurism is helpful and necessary is that the future hasn't happened yet. It is still being shaped, and it's being shaped by us. And so one of the things that futurism can help us do, in the same way that science fiction has done this in the past, is it can help us shape the future by pointing out the possibilities. And, you know, in science fiction, the great example of this is Star Trek, where, you know, practically every future technology that, you know, a whole bunch of the technology we have today were first seen, you know, 30 or 50 years ago, a little more than 50, I think, in a Star Trek series, you know, like flip phones, they have been and gone. they were the first in the original Star Trek series. Tablet computers, you know, the Google guys talk about how they want Google, the Google search function ultimately to operate the way the Star Trek computer does, right? Where you ask it a question and it gives you an answer, right? This, as if you're talking to a person. And so, you know, these things can, imagining the possibilities of the future can help give direction and inspiration for the people who are actually developing the technology and making it happen, or for people who are finding uses for this technology of trying to imagine how could this help us live differently, and the futurist can help direct that. Now, futurism, when it goes wrong, though, can also have a deleterious effect. And this is sort of, I did a lot of this sort of shooting down of this dystopianism that's very popular in futurism today. And primarily it's about machines, right? Machines and artificial intelligence and robots. And every single movie you watch, there's a killer robot that's going to become sentient. It's going to kill us all. The famous one, of course, is Terminator. But in, you know, Marvel did Ultron. And there's too many examples to even try to list here. I was disappointed, actually, in the Picard series of Star Trek that they did a couple years ago, that one of the plot points there is that they had artificial, they had basically androids or robots building Federation ships on the shipyards on Mars, and there was an uprising by the androids, and they fought against us and had to be defeated. And that's like this whole background for the series. Well, so it's like even the famously optimistic Star Trek series had to have a sort of mini robot apocalypse storyline. And one of the problems with that is when you have this relentless negativism about that, it can actually work to suppress innovation in that field. And I think, you know, I talked before about environmentalism leads people to say, oh, it's, you know, we're not gonna have no more fossil fuels. We're gonna be doing this. We can't do that. Environmentalism is one of the things that's a big drag. This sort of environmental doomsaying is a big drag on innovation and growth. And so you can actually prevent some of the future from happening because you are convinced of a dystopian outcome that doesn't really have evidence to support it. All right, so that's what futurism is. That's why it's something worth talking about and worth going into. And I would say just a few words and then leave the rest up for discussion about what objectivism has to add. And the way I put the question is objectivism a philosophy of the future? And of course the answer is hell yes, objectivism is a philosophy of the future. It is an optimistic, forward-looking, pro-growth, pro-technology, pro-science and pro-innovation philosophy. And there's three key ways I think in which that's the case. Now, the thing about objectivism that really strikes me as making it the philosophy of the future is I talked about earlier about how a lot of futurism is somebody projecting their pre-existing philosophy onto, you know, future events. And, you know, their environmentalist philosophy, their sort of Luddism, you know, that the robots are all going to kill us, etc. And what struck me is most philosophies, far from being ready for the future, haven't even caught up with the past. You know, they haven't even reckoned with they haven't finished reckoning with the Industrial Revolution, much less what, you know, the information age and what's going to come next. So what, there are three things I think objectivism has that can help us learn. All right, so I mentioned, you know, most philosophies haven't even reckoned with the Industrial Revolution. Well, objectivism and Ayn Rand are a huge exception to that, in that she looked at that history of the last 200 years of the Industrial Revolution and drew a whole bunch of crucial, 50 years. But the point is that she drew a bunch of crucial conclusions from that, the primary one being the importance of reason as the source of wealth. That wealth wasn't created by guys twisting bolts in factories. It was created by people sitting around and thinking up new ideas. Well, in an age of increasing automation, and the automation is not really new. We've been we've been in an age of automation since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. That's what the Industrial Revolution was. More and more human tasks being automated. And so she drew the conclusion from that, that, well, if all these human tasks can be automated by somebody coming up with a new invention, a new machine that does it, then the real source of wealth is the person who comes up with the idea. And that's a huge value in terms of the role of automation today, because that's sort of what a tendency that, left over from the Industrial Revolution, that, oh, the robots are going to come along, they're going to take all of our jobs, we're all going to be poor, so we have to have universal basic income, or we have to have this, or we have to have that, in order to prevent us from all being, basically left poor and destitute because the robots are doing all of have taken all of our jobs. And what Ayn Rand is saying, well, this has been true all along. This is the basic nature of production, that it comes from ideas and not just from physical labor. And so the way to deal with the onset of automation is to be in the idea business, to focus on what can't be automated, which is conceptual and creative thinking. And that's the real source of wealth. And that it's, if you're engaged in sort of any job that involves rote repetition or mere physical action is going to be automated. So you should, as much as possible, be in the job of doing the thinking about how things are going to happen, of doing the conceptual and creative thinking that actually drives the economy. And which is a good idea whether there's any automation or not, or whether there's more automation than there is now or not. Now, the second big thing is, and I talked about this a couple weeks ago in a thing on post-scarcity economics, which is the effect that altruism has as, again, a sort of a dead idea, or an idea that has been surpassed by events, but which still has this great purchase in people's heads and causes them not to understand what's happening in the present or what's going to be happening in the future. And so there's still this assumption of a kind of a zero-sum society where somebody has to be sacrificed for the sake of somebody else. And that's what a lot of people do. They say, well, we're going to have automation, but that means that everybody's going to be out of a job. Only a few people are going to be wealthy. So we have to have mass redistribution and government controlling the economy in order to deal with the fact that, they saw this idea that if huge amounts of new wealth are being created by automation, that must mean it's being taken away from somebody else. And that I see fundamentally as the philosophical influence of altruism as a philosophy, which says somebody's sacrifice is always necessary. Somebody's sacrifice is always required. And it's a matter of whether you're sacrificing yourself to others or others are sacrificing themselves to you. And so it tends to see this zero-sum view of the world in which if huge progress and huge creation of wealth is happening, that somebody's got to be impoverished. And so therefore we need to have government come in and we need to have these interventions to prevent that from happening. Now, the third thing is, I think objectivism is tying into some of the reasons we just talked about in the first two, the belief in reason, the belief that self-interest, that people acting by their mutual self-interest can make everybody better off. That chases away the dystopianism in favor of an optimistic and benevolent view of the future. And objectivist has a benevolent view of the future because it has a benevolent view of human nature and of the nature of the world. We have the benevolent universe premise. We view human beings fundamentally as people who go out and come up with new ideas and do new thinking and come up with new innovations that make life better, which is sort of an antidote to this sort of reflexive dystopianism you get everywhere else, where changes and technological change is always viewed as, well, but what about, all our information is going to be stolen by big corporations, or the robots are going to take all of our jobs, or the robots are going to come kill us. Every time they see an innovation or a change, people immediately go to, what's the worst thing that could possibly happen? What's the dystopian result? And of course, history shows, well, that's not what happens. We don't go straight to the dystopian result. We've actually had, hundreds of years of progress. So the third big thing I want to add there is that objectivism views achievement and technology and innovation as something to be celebrated and not feared. And those are the three big things. The emphasis on reason, specifically meaning creative and conceptual thinking. The emphasis, the rejection of altruism, and the idea that, you know, if we that increases in wealth don't have to impoverish everyone. We can all work together by mutual consent and to mutual advantage. And then third is this benevolent view of the universe and of man's place in it that creates an optimism and chases away the dystopianism of a lot of today's futures. All right, so with all that said, which I went longer than I expected, but I have many thoughts on this, I'm going to open it up and people to add questions, comments, disagreements, etc.
Great. Yeah, we'd encourage anyone that wants to join to raise your hand. We'll bring you up to the stage. I've got a lot of questions I've been working on as well as you've been talking. One of the first ones is, you know, Rand talks about the role of intellectuals. Hello. And what, you know, how to, is the main role for intellectuals to help prepare people for these technological changes so that they're not enemies of the future?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, the way I like to put it is the role of intellectuals is supposed to be to explain what's happening in the world and not to explain it away. And a lot of times you get, you know, the role of the intellectual these days is to explain away what's happening in the world by saying, well, no, that's not really what's happening. And I think that's what they've been doing since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, explaining away the Industrial Revolution. I mean, you know, a great example of that is Karl Marx, right? Who says, no. See, this great liberation of labor that's happened in the Industrial Revolution, it's actually just the same old system. It's wage slavery. They're robber barons. Nothing has changed at all from the Middle Ages. It's worse than the Middle Ages because he actually had tends to have a rosy and romanticized view of how much of the Middle Ages, of the economy of the Middle Ages. So, you know, a lot of this is people explaining away. So yes, absolutely. By explaining what's already happened and then anticipating, you know, the future of that, is to prepare people for what is going to be happening and what's going to be required to survive and thrive in the future.
Thank you. Go ahead, Marcos.
Hello, guys. How are you? I'm sorry I interrupted before. I just didn't know how this worked. So... Very interesting what you have said, Rob, and I very much agree with most of your points. But this is an issue that I also think about a lot. And my idea is we have never been actually able to completely fulfill this idea of the Enlightenment, ultimately, I think. I don't know if you guys would agree, which is, you know, what you say in principle, you know, the freedom of the individual, the sanctity of the individual, and then that society can be a community of the commons, if you will, rather than something imposed, etc. And, you know, and then again, everybody pursuing their own interest can generate wealth. So it's not a zero-sum game, a mercantilistic kind of thing, the economic game. But we have never actually quite, I mean, I think this is an idea that's been around, as I said, since the Enlightenment, and we have never quite been able to implement it, obviously, but we have gotten much closer, and we are definitely ways better. I don't know if you guys are familiarized with the work of Steve Pinker. I mean, I definitely think along those lines, and you know, but in spite of that, you know, you still have the Industrial Revolution was profoundly dystopian in its beginning. I mean, it was only of benefit to the majority in the long run. I don't know if you guys would agree with me, and I think that there's data on this. You know, it took several decades, you know, until the average wealth, for example, of England, you know, increased. And if you measure things as like personal happiness, then it will get maybe even a little more complicated. But in any case, my point is, then that happened, then you have the, you know, the phenomenon of the world wars still. So there was a very strong movement of thinking along this line by the end of the 19th century as well. I mean, you read some of these guys, Julius Verne will be, you know, one of the most prominent examples. So there's...
do you want to give Rob a chance?
I completely agree with you that we should strive for that, but things can go wrong. Let's put it this way. Whatever can go wrong will go wrong given enough time. That's Murphy's Law, I think. No? So we should be, I mean, the skepticism should be very prevalent whenever we're going to take any of these steps. But again,
Okay, Marcus, you want to give him a chance to answer?
Yeah, well, no, this is all great stuff. I'm happy you brought this all up. Okay, so one small quibble, which is, I'm not as certain about the issue that, you know, I do think, you know, the Industrial Revolution took a while to take off and to have a really powerful effect on people's well-being. I mean, as any geometric growth, you know, any pattern of geometric growth, you know, what does it look like at the beginning? You know, but relative to later growth, the beginning part of the curve, of the upward curve, looks small, looks almost nearly flat. It's kind of indiscernible, the growth, and then suddenly it explodes. And that's kind of what happened with the Industrial Revolution. But that was, you know, it was, the growth was happening at the beginning. It just didn't become as starkly noticeable until it had a couple of decades to compound. Now, what I'd also say is that you had a mass exodus. One of the things that fed the Industrial Revolution is you had a mass exodus of people from agricultural jobs into the cities, into industry. And a lot of that wouldn't have been happening if living on the farm, if living out in the agricultural economy was so much better and more fulfilling than working in the factory. So, you know, it's clear that at the time, this was something that was actually conceived by the people who were doing it. Nobody was rounding them up and forcing them to work in the factories. It was conceived by the people who were working there to be a better option than what they have. And I think a lot of this look back of, oh, look how dystopian the early Industrial Revolution was, is like, well, yes, it was absolutely dystopian by our standards today, but everything was dystopian by our standards today. Everything was, you know, life was pretty miserable for everyone by our standards today. And on a lot of cases, you know, life out on the farm, life working on, you know, in manual labor and agriculture in, you know, 1795 was even worse than life working in the factory. All right, so that's I'm not a great expert on that, so I don't want to get into the weeds, but I think that's just something to think about.
Completely agree in that regard. And to a great extent, the immigration into the cities in that time.
I think Rob cut out a little bit. I think he was still answering.
Finish sentence. I'll get
back
to this.
Oh, I'm sorry.
We have not fully implemented the vision of the Enlightenment, but having partially implemented it is pretty darn good. You know, and you're always going to face resistance, and like you mentioned, the world wars. You know, you're going to have people who harken back to this romanticism of a pre-industrial, pre-technological, pre-rational age, which is very much what motivated, you know, the fascists. The fascists had this, I mean, is romanticism in the philosophical sense of like German romanticism, this belief and worship of emotions and blood and soil that was a very anti-Enlightenment viewpoint. So we still have, I think, an ideological contest and a philosophical contest going on. And that's why we have not, you know, fully implemented this, because first of all, the vision Enlightenment was kind of vague. They didn't really know what all it would entail. We had to find a lot of that stuff out, figure it out as we went along. And also because there's always going to be this philosophical contest of people who, you know, they dislike the Enlightenment because it doesn't leave enough room for religion, or it doesn't leave enough room for blood and soil, or whatever it is that they want to, you know, nostalgically keep about the past. So anyway, you go back to Marcos.
So yes, much very much agree with you. The movement of the peasants into the urban centers in the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, remember that it was driven also to a great extent because there was an agricultural revolution preceding that that
yes.
very much pushed people out of the countryside because the farming was becoming so efficient that you needed much less people to farm. And then those people literally had nothing else to do than going. But in any case, I fully agree with you. We very much have done progress. But my point even before was that along that progress, there are big bumps and potential big setbacks. So my point was that we should be very much aware of that because since our technology also can potentially have a very much more disastrous consequence if it goes wrong, Black Mirror anyone. and we remember we also escaped a nuclear war by the skin of our teeth when you look at it, and we're still not done with it. So my point is, completely agree with you. We should strive for the ideas of the Enlightenment, everything you described at the beginning, as a compass to which to aim for. But the big warnings are there, like the same Nazi phenomenon that you just described, which coincidentally they saw themselves as something very advanced for their times as well. You know, it was very weird, very nonsensical ideology. But let's not get into that. The idea is that we should be aware. We should be aware that we are playing with fire.
Now, one thing I think also is one of the lessons I think of futurism is of sort of looking at how future technology develops is that I think the lesson of World War II and the Cold War, nuclear weapons and all that, the lesson of that is that strongman dictatorship and totalitarianism are not compatible with the future, right? That, you know, in places, you know, without the totalitarianism of the Soviets or of the Nazis.
Very important point.
You know, none of this technology would have produced the reason that made the Nazis such big villains is that they took over an advanced, industrialized, technologically competent country. You know, they had lots of great engineers. They had Wernher von Braun and all those guys building rockets. So, you know, a country with high technology and advancing technology and all that is 10 times more dangerous when it becomes totalitarian, when it adopts when it goes backwards in its ideas. And so that's one of the other warnings is that, you know, I think it makes me kind of a George Bushian, you know, he always said that his goal was to end tyranny in the world by the end of the century. And I'm like, yes, absolutely. We need to, as a matter of survival, because God knows what technology we're going to have in 2100 that we don't want to be in the hands of these lunatics. Anyway, that's just getting on the
You know, that's a kind of intellectual thing that comes up about the future. Is another Dark Ages possible, or are we too technologically advanced for that?
Well, I think, you know, it's a Dark Age. It happens. Dark Ages are back in the day, even when, you know, the actual Dark Age of the middle, you know, the Middle Ages or the early Middle Ages. By the late Middle Ages, we're, you know, making huge advances again. But there's a period of like 300 years in there where things are really, you know, the Dark Ages were really dark. And where basically everything that was built by classical civilization was being torn down. And not really anything was being built in its place. And but all Dark Ages are local. That's one of the other lessons of history, which is that now they can be local in the sense of most of Europe, right? But while civilization was being torn down by barbarian invasions and collapse in Western Europe, you know, the Byzantine Empire was still there and maintained a large zone of control. And so my hope is that, especially with today's advances in communications and, you know, back then the idea that, you know, the Western ideas would reach as far as China or someplace like that, or East Asia would be ridiculous. And of course, now they have reached East Asia. They're widely known and to some extent adopted in various countries there. Maybe less so in China these days, but even there it has an impact. So what makes me optimistic about the future is that the technology and the scientific knowledge, but also some of the philosophical knowledge, some of the Enlightenment ideas, ideals, and some of the political ideals have already spread and been adopted throughout a huge portion of the world. So if we, you know, Ronald Reagan used to say at the end of the Cold War, you know, that he talked to a Cuban refugee or something like that, who said he felt sorry for him. He says, "What do you mean? Why do you feel sorry for me?" He says, "Because you have no place to escape to," right? So when communism came to Cuba, he could escape. That guy could escape to America. But if America, if communism comes to America, if America's destroyed, there's going to be no place to escape to, because, you know, the communists are going to control everything. Maybe that was true in, you know, circa 1980. I really don't think that there's that's possible today, because there's, you know, if the worst were to happen to the U.S. and we were collapsed and become a dictatorship, there would be other places that would be able to take that, to eventually take that leadership. There'd be other places where these ideas survive and where progress continues.
That's fair. Let me ask you, is it fair to say that futurism can easily become utopian, whether it's like heaven or equality of outcomes? I mean, people are kind of taking their eyes off the present to some degree.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's oddly a lot of futurism these days is dystopian. And when it's not dystopian, it does tend to be utopian, right? and utopian in the sense, now, you know, in the original sense, that, you know, Sir Thomas More's sense of meaning no place, right? and utopianism gets a bad rap because the idea is that when you do these projections, like I said, when you do something that's a projection based on your wish fulfillment of what you would like to see happen, of the future you wish would happen, you tend to create something that's utterly unrealistic as a future. And one of my favorites on this is this idea, is this fully automated luxury communism idea, or various sort of watered down versions of that, like universal basic income, where the idea is, oh, the machines are going to be doing all the work. You don't have to have a job anymore. And, you know, you'll get paid a nice, regular paycheck by the government. You'll be able to live a nice life without having to worry about work at all. And of course, you know, anybody who's ever managed a highly complex technological system is going to be able to throw some cold water on that. That actually, in some ways, the more complex a technological system, the more spectacularly it can all fall apart if somebody isn't monitoring it and fixing it and taking care of it all the time. If you don't have, you know, you actually require a whole new class of workers to manage an automated system. You know, how many people work in IT, information technology, these days, right? And this is the thing that was associated. So, you know, I found a great document from like 1964, 63 or 64, these people talking about how, oh, we're headed towards a cybernetic. I don't think they didn't quite use cybernetic. They used some variation on that. That was like the term at the term in vogue at the time. But the cybernetic future is coming, where all this computer technology is going to automate everything, and we won't have to work, and therefore we should have this giant new welfare state. And they were writing this off to Lyndon Johnson as part of the basis for the as part of the agitation for the Great Society welfare programs. And the funny thing is, you know, these people imagined that the computerized society we live in today was all going to go automatically and nobody have to do anything. And of course, you know, there are now hundreds of thousands, at least, I'm sure millions of people employed in the IT business, you know, who are doing all the work of patching together all these different systems that don't work automatically, that need to be maintained and functioning. So that's where I see, you know, the sort of starry-eyed utopianism. And I think what drives it is it's bad science fiction, where people want to, they have a philosophical loyalty that they want to somehow fantasize that would all work. And so they create science fiction about how it's all going to work without doing the hard work of saying, well, you know, how do these systems actually work? How are they going to function? Is this actually possible? I mean, if I could come to terms with the fact that I'm not going to get a flying car, I think maybe some of these people could come to terms with the fact that they're not going to get fully automated luxury communism.
They're still going to try. I thought it was quite, it was good when you were talking about how these people, they just basically, it seemed like you were saying, use their agenda to Jag, if you want to jump in here, you're welcome to.
Yeah, Rob, I was just looking at some of the questions that we got for our Instagram takeover, and one was about accelerationism, which was a new term to me, but I was wondering if that had crossed your radar and if you had any thoughts.
Oh, yeah. Well, accelerationism I have thoughts about, but accelerationism is not as nice as it sounds. So you think in the context of futurism, you think, oh, accelerationism means we should expand technological progress. We should be, you know, doing all these things to promote and supercharge our growth and technological progress. That's not what accelerationism is, at least not in the version I've encountered, and it's probably what this is about. Accelerationism in this viewpoint is we have all these contradictions in society that are leading to conflict and collapse, and so we should try to accelerate the conflict. And some of the people who do this are like your alt-right white nationalist types who basically say, you know, the race war is coming or the American Civil War is coming, so we should accelerate it. We should make things worse. We should increase the contradictions. And that's actually an old Marxist thing that they used to do, right? So there are all these inherent contradictions in capitalism. Capitalism will finally be torn apart by its own internal contradictions. So we should, they used to have a term, and I can't remember the exact wording of it anymore. But it's basically, we should accelerate the contradictions, or we should increase and exaggerate the contradictions so that the existing system will collapse, and then we can replace it with our ideal utopian version. And I think that's what accelerationism sort of means. And my recollection is it's associated largely with the sort of the alt-right types, but it probably has a wider, you know, it's a popular idea. The communists used to do it. Anybody in any I mean, in a way, John Galt is an accelerationist in that sense, you know, in that he says, you know, the system is heading towards collapse, so let's collapse it so that we can then have what comes after it. But in generally, it's used by people who have less benevolent intentions, because he wants to say, okay, let's, you know, let's get this dictatorship, you know, we're collapsing the dictatorship, let's knock the props out from under it, watch it collapse, and then we can have a free society again. A lot of the accelerationists are people who have much less benevolent intentions.
Yeah, I saw that there was kind of an alt-right version of it, but also that there was a left version of it coming out of critical social justice theory. But I thought it was interesting. I'm like, well, they're wrong, because actually if we did increase, you know, basically hyper-capitalism, which is a far cry from what we have today, mm-hmm. That would be fine by me.
Well, and the great thing is, if we increase capitalism, I don't know about hyper-capitalism or not, but if we increase the amount of capitalism, it would not lead to a cataclysmic conflict. Because, you know, a lot of these things are fantasies of, let's have the big final battle, the big final conflict. I think they're fantasies that we're going to go into the future by fighting each other. Right? We'll fight each other and one side will win, and that's how we'll get into the future we want. Whereas, you know, capitalism, the whole point of capitalism is, no, we're going to build a lot of stuff, and that's how we're going to get into the future. And we're not going to try to, we don't want to fight each other. We want to fight each other as little as possible so we can go build a bunch of stuff. And that's the sort of benevolent version of, yeah, I think the accelerationism we need is accelerate capitalism, accelerate innovation, accelerate growth, and let's get us, you know, into this science fiction future that we want to live in. I mean, you know, the good kind of science fiction future.
Yeah, no, I agree. You know, I think their motives may be bad, but their premises are worse. And, you know, if they want to get on board with reducing drags on capitalism, then we can take wages and see how it plays out.
That's what I was going to talk about, that I think to some degree, that anyone with an ideology has their own vision of what inevitable victory looks like, and also the, you know, catastrophizing the, you know, if your opponent's views get put into place.
Yeah, yeah. I've personally become much more of a gradualist, because I think one of the things, we had a discussion about this like a couple months ago. But one of the things I've taken away from, you know, somebody asked if I'm familiar with Steven Pinker. Yes, I've interviewed him. I've read his books, and especially his book Enlightenment Now, where he goes in this long litany, and it's like way too much detail. And precisely because it's way too much detail, it's exactly the right amount of detail because, you know, people are so pessimistic these days. They're so inclined to think everything's getting worse. They need way too much detail on how everything's getting better. And that affected me in one way, which is that it made me more of a gradualist. You know, because the idea is that, well, if everything has gotten so much better, and what shocked me is you look at most of these graphs of economic, material, even, you know, educational progress and all of that, and huge things we think of as huge cataclysmic events like World War II are hardly a blip. They hardly register. The progress just keeps going. You know, World War II, 100 million people killed, you know, the worldwide disaster and people, things being blown up, and civilization just keeps going past it with hardly, it's like a speed bump. And it made me realize that, you know, what we have is so much is going right that I think we should be focused a lot less on the cataclysmic possibilities or of how you have to totally tear down the existing system. And much our approach should be much more gradualist and focus on, well, look, you know, can we make ourselves a little freer over here and make ourselves a little freer over here and just keep chipping away? And what you'll see is that as you do that, life continues to get better and it gets better faster. And you have this thing where instead of one cataclysmic showdown where you have to totally defeat your enemies, you just do one little thing at a time. And things just get incrementally better, and the results and the benefits compound, you know, annual compounding, you know, adds up to a huge amount at the end. And that, I think I've become a little bit more of a gradualist in my idea of what the ideal political change looks like.
That's fair. I consider myself an incrementalist too. I think what happens is that whether it's the administrative state or the squad, the lessons that they've taken from lockdowns or what have you is that we can make huge changes. We don't have to be gradualists. We can go for the whole socialist, you know, kebab right now.
But did they, though? Right? Everywhere I've been so far, you would think that the lockdowns and the pandemic never happened.
Yeah.
I mean, think about that. I like to use World War II as an example. Because a lot of people got super excited in World War One and World War Two, a lot of people got super excited of, oh, this regimented system of command and control where everybody wears the same uniform and sleeps in the barracks and they all follow orders and they sacrifice and they don't call it recycling, but you know, they take their old newspapers and they bring them in to be salvaged and they accept rationing. Isn't this great? This is the ideal future. We have all this power. We can now impose this system. And, you know, they always try to find, you know, this is where the term the moral equivalent of war comes from, right? They always try to find out, let's harness this willingness to do this in wartime. Let's harness this for our other goals over here and over there. And what happens is, the minute the war is over, and actually at least a little before the war is over, because this is how it started to happen in like 44, everybody says, okay, great, let's go back to normal. And there was a Cole Porter musical, not one of his better ones, done in the late 40s called Call Me Mister. And it was about the absolute joy and elation of these guys, you know, leaving the army and getting called Mister again instead of Sergeant or Private. And so, you know, and people just sort of went back. They were very, very happy to get back to normal life after the emergency. I'm seeing the same thing with the pandemic. I think some people have gone, you know, move this way. I think there are places where people are just, you know, they've just said, we're just going to get COVID. and they take too few precautions. But it shows how resistant people are to actually, you know, this idea that, oh, people will accept all these radical changes. No, they won't. People are highly resistant to it. And it doesn't matter, blue state, red state, they will go back to normal as soon as they, you know, as soon as they can, or sometimes sooner, as soon as it's socially acceptable. As soon as enough other people do it, that you have this sort of everything flips, and that, I think that's already happened with the pandemic. It happened, you know, sometime early this year.
You haven't been to San Francisco lately, Rob.
Maybe I haven't. Maybe there are a few places. Out here in Virginia, it's pretty much happened.
That's good. Hopefully, the monkeypox thing won't get too bad. But I want to welcome TAS founder David Kelly to the stage.
By the way, I want to say monkeypox is an awesome name for a disease. It's like it's like a 14-year-old thought it up. It's just like, hey, you know, well, let's come up with a really scary sounding name for disease. I know, monkeypox. All right. So David, come on.
Laughing. Now, Rob just came in late, so I missed part of it. What Rob was saying about World War II is absolutely right. And my father was a vet from World War II in the Navy. When the war was over, he couldn't wait to get his law degree, marry my mother, have children, 5 altogether. And, he was very typical of that generation, I think. So, yeah, back to normal. But here's a question for Rob. I believe in incremental change too. We see it happening economically in business. Every advance in technology, sponsors mm-hmm. further advances. But it works in politics too, I think. And that's where the issue of gradualism comes up. The left is also working on gradualism, maybe not to the satisfaction of the squad, but they're working in a democratic system where they have to convince a legislature to move forward, but they keep doing it. The Build Back Better program, sank, but now they're bringing back key elements of it at, 700-something million. So they're getting, and the state has been growing, as we all know, over decades. Step by step. And I wonder how, we've been fighting a resistance battle against it incrementally, so to speak. And I think that's all we can do. But what are some strategies that we can apply that would reverse the political creep of socialism?
Okay, so let me say a couple of quick things about that, though. You've asked a question that could take an hour to answer, and we have 4 minutes left. So... I'll do the briefest possible version of it. Maybe I'll do another future clubhouse on that. I think of us as the new Fabians. The Fabian socialists, where they had this incremental gradualist approach. It's actually named after a general, Roman general named Fabius, who's was called the delayer, because his strategy was he couldn't figure out how to beat Hannibal. Hannibal was coming marching towards Rome. He couldn't figure out how to beat him. So he's arranged for a series of battles where he basically fought the battle and retreated. And his job was just to delay Hannibal long enough that he would sort of run out of steam. And it actually worked.
Yeah.
And so I think that's, it's a much better analogy for what we're doing now than for the socialists in the early 20th century, where, it's like we're trying to, in a way, we're trying to buy time for capitalism to keep growing and producing great new things. By stopping one little thing after another and taking this giant Build Back Better stimulus thing with all sorts of new government regulations. And, maybe they can get through a much smaller version of it with a lot of the worst stuff taken out. And a few of the bad things still in there, but a lot of the worst stuff taken out. But what we still haven't really figured out how to do, and I think a critical mass you need to reach to be able to do this is we haven't figured out how to stop the one-way ratchet, right? This is the idea that once a government program gets passed, you will never get rid of it. There've been like a handful of examples, like the Interstate Commerce Commission, a handful of examples that actually were gotten rid of and abolished. But, the big disappointment to me was Obamacare. We got a Republican president, a Republican majority, both houses of Congress. They promised us for 6 years, the big thing we're going to do is we're going to repeal Obamacare, and they couldn't manage to do it. I think the problem is that ideologically, philosophically, you have to get a large enough critical mass to make it possible for you to rally public opinion for the much harder job of getting rid of something once it's been passed. And obviously, my disappointment with the Republicans stemming from that is that they showed that they were still too committed to the welfare state and to big government and didn't really want the responsibility of having to get rid of it.
Okay.
I think I remember John McCain being one of the final votes against, but be that as it may, it was a great topic today, Rob. Thank you for doing it. Tomorrow at 5 p.m., the Atlas Society Asks features our CEO, Jennifer Grossman, asking Barbara Oakley, professor of engineering, about the state of education and learning. Thursday, back here on Clubhouse, also at 5 p.m. Eastern, Professor Jason Hill will be here discussing the nature of political happiness, another fascinating topic. September 2nd is going to be our second annual Atlas Shrug Day, the current date in the book. And it was a lot of fun last year. We broke out into breakout rooms with individual scholars, very interactive. So mark your calendars. It'll be on a Friday. Great topic, Rob. Thanks for doing this. Thanks to everyone who participated. Jag, final thoughts?
Yeah, I just wanted to add an extra note on tomorrow's interview with Professor Barbara Oakley. In addition to having produced the world's most popular massive online education course on how to learn, she's also, this is partially what caught our eye, she's a co-author of a book called Pathological Altruism, which really was maybe one of the first academic books to take a look at what are some of the downsides of altruism and even empathy. So I'm going to be interested to hear her take on that, as well as she has some interesting criticism of Ayn Rand. I think she kind of has an appreciation for objectivism, but also says that some of maybe the, that some great geniuses and visionaries can sometimes have aspects of their personality which help them to propel their visions forward and persevere against adversity and conflict, but that also can have some negative sides as well. So I'm open to hearing about it, and we'll debate it. So I hope you guys will join us tomorrow.
Now, I remember Barbara Oakley's work on pathological altruism, so I'm definitely going to listen to that. That sounds awesome. Interesting.
Cool.
Great. Thanks again for everyone who participated. Hope to see you later this week. Take care.
Thanks, everyone.